Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, Anfidela, I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey. You did it again. We could not do it without you. I don't know what happened tonight, but we're all staring at the switchboard here, and all of a sudden the show's going to go on 1 second, and the next thing I see is they're waiting for the host of the show to call in. But, Audrey, you pulled it out. Thank you very much. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Keith Haley, your host, and we want to thank Donnie Cash for taking us on that trip across the United States, where he visited 90 different cities and states, and he sings that song, I'm told, without ever looking at the lyric sheet. Absolutely remarkable. Emily and Mike, thank you for being with us tonight, and I think we're going to have an interesting show. Folks have been waiting for this one, and I know, Emily, that you have a particular interest in this, because a long time ago you told me that your favorite television show throughout history was Matt Dillon, a show about a U.S. Marshal, and tonight we're going to have a U.S. Marshal on the show, so it's going to be very, very interesting. Ladies and gentlemen, the purpose of our show is the same as it is every week. We discuss news issues, events, and developments, and it's always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of the criminal justice field. I don't know what criminal justice would be like without a little humor, and our show is dedicated to these tireless police and court corrections and juvenile justice professionals that serve us throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. And that's becoming more prevalent, isn't it? More and more because of the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan, we hear about our local criminal justice agents, local cops, local corrections officials going overseas to assist in the security and development of those nations. But anyway, what we do is we try to look inside the criminal justice field and criminal justice practice, and someone once paid us a compliment, I think, and they said that we were the NPR of criminal justice, and we'll accept that as a compliment indeed. You're listening to the show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, which is, what an understatement to say, a leading-edge technology. And Alan Levy is the chief executive officer of Blog Talk Radio. And he's the genius behind this medium. And now there are literally thousands and thousands of shows on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You talk about something that caught on in a little more than a year from going to just a handful of shows per day and per week. To now to the point where there are literally thousands. If you go to the Blog Talk Radio Network and look over the list of shows. You can search in who knows how many genres of category. But you'll find out that there's a show there or two that you'll be interested in. Very interesting. The politics section alone, which our show is listed in, there's more than 150 radio shows. And the names of lots of those people who host those shows, you will recognize. What is possible with this Blog Talk Radio Network? Well, first of all, any person, any interest group, any organization, that can be from cigars to astronomy, darts to homicide investigation, they can have their own show broadcasting live and streaming audio over the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. I always like to repeat this because I'm not sure everybody gets it the first time. It's something that's almost too good to be true. But anybody can host a show. Any organization will see them, have them on the network. They can host a show. They can broadcast live and streaming audio over the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. And how much does that cost the host or host organization of the show? Absolutely nothing. And you can broadcast as much as, I keep saying 14 hours a week, I suspect it's more now, but at least 14 hours a week you can provide this service to people. And the shows are immediately archived, and as of about a month ago when we came up with a new the new console, I didn't, but Alan Levy did, the new network and the new console technology, all the shows are archived immediately. And you can go back and hear every show that we've hosted, for example. We'll go back and on the website for the Jumbo Justice Radio Show, you can see 54, I think about 54, maybe 55 shows, and you can listen to all of those. And I know some of the people that are listening or have listened before who are faculty members in high schools and colleges and universities have used some of the shows to instruct their students with. So we've had shows on everything imaginable, policewomen in Bahrain, the prison system in Haiti, on and on and on. And tonight will be another one of those, I think, landmark shows as we talk about the United States Marshal Service. And I'll be getting to our guests in just a moment. But just think of it, ladies and gentlemen, you can have your own show, your organization can have one, your college, your university could have one, and use this as an instructional technology vehicle for your students. So if you don't like this show, it's like that motto on the back of the Jesus box, instead of get your own box, go ahead and get your own show. What we're going to do tonight, we're going to have the show broken up into the same segments we usually do. We'll have listener call-ins for those who choose to do that. Some nights we have callers, some nights we don't. We've had them from out of the nation, and we had them from local communities very near to where we broadcast from. But we'll also talk a little bit about criminal justice news, and we always do that. And goodness knows there's lots of it to talk about. And then tonight we'll have, as our guest, I'll get a long formal introduction when he comes online, but we're going to have Dr. Alan Smith, who currently is a professor of criminal justice, but Alan was twice appointed the U.S. Marshal for the 7th District of Ohio twice. He was appointed by two presidents, President Jimmy Carter in the 1970s and President Bill Clinton in the 1990s. So that's remarkable to be able to come back in the Marshal Service you know, like that more than a decade later. So I hope you enjoyed the show last week when we had Danny Chandler. Wasn't he on the ball about the subject of surveillance technology and what's going on in the law enforcement and private security fields? And that show, of course, is also archived, so you can hear that there. Here's what you do as a listener or a caller. You can listen on your computer with Windows Media Player, of course, but you can call in to the number 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. And you can hear the entire show on your phone. And then you're able, when I click you on our switchboard, I can hold five calls at a time. All five of us can talk to each other and hear every word, every note that's on the show. So that number again is 347-996-5983. And as I mentioned before, if you want to go back and listen to some previous shows, you can get those playbacks on the Jumbo Justice Radio site on Blog Talk Radio. Dot com. Audrey, I know your joke is a little different tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening for the first time, Audrey always, who is a blonde, I might point out. Audrey's been a collector of blonde jokes since she was a little girl. And she has the world's largest collection of blonde jokes. And the one tonight is kind of interesting, and I know you always check these out with Emily and Mike, right? Emily and Mike? Okay. Let's see what this joke is tonight. I think folks will probably enjoy this one. Here we go.
Professor Haley, tonight's blonde joke is actually a series of questions and answers. Emily and Mike liked them, so here we go. What do you call an eternity? Four blondes in four cars at a four-way stop. Why do blondes have the letters TGIF written on their shoes? Toes going first. What do smart blondes and UFOs have in common? You always hear about them, but never see them. Why do blondes always smile during lightning storms? They think their picture is being taken.
That's certainly a good one there. We'll put that one in the keeper file, Audrey. Thank you. Thank you very much. We've been worrying about a little slight uptick in crime here since the FBI reports just came out at the beginning of the month. So I think we've been a little remiss, and we haven't been playing our announcement from the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms, and I'm sure this message is directed toward the criminals that are carrying guns. So, Mike, is it okay if we play this one tonight? Okay, we'll go ahead and do it.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
I like that, and I appreciate the coalition giving us that message for the criminals, and perhaps they'll hear that and give up their guns. But excellent. So we hope they pay homage to that the message in that public service announcement. I want to start off in the news tonight. I thought this was kind of interesting. And of all the different organizations that you can join, and you know that we did a show here, probably 2 or 3 months ago, where we did a show on the criminal justice system saving energy on the issue of, the sustainable planet. And we had some ideas that, police, courts, and corrections agencies can do in order to conserve energy. And I noticed this item in the news today, and I thought it was very interesting. And I didn't know this organization existed, but here we go. It says, a cheap system to recycle human waste into biogas and fertilizer may allow $2.6 billion people in the world to access toilets and reduce global warming. This is put out by an Indian government environmental expert. Mr. Pathak, founder of the Subla International Social Service Organization, said his group plans to push the system at the 7th Annual World Toilet Summit to be held in New Delhi at the end of October. Darn it. I mean, you find out about these things late, but I had no idea that there was a World Toilet Organization. I suspect that most of you didn't either. And that's real important for, the community that I live in, because we're sort of the home of the American Standard Toilet. And as I'm fond of saying to friends and acquaintances out of town, we do more flushes right here in this town than any other place on the planet. And the American Standard connection is virtually everywhere. I can walk into the Crown Plaza Hotel in Bucharest, Romania, for example, and there they are, American Standard. But what this organization is dedicated to is providing toilets to nearly 730 million people in India who lack them. I would have never thought it. It says their Millennium Development Goals, set in South Africa in 2002, aim by 2015 to cut by half the 2.6 billion people worldwide who don't have toilets. I never thought about that. I mean, all the things that people are deprived of, you just sort of assume. But they're going to try to do that. And he says India's contribution would be a toilet system that organically breaks down feces into trapped biogas that can be burned to provide cooking fuel and electricity, and they can convert that urine then into fertilizer. says, now we want others to know about this technology, and it was recently installed at Kabul in Afghanistan. Imagine that, because it can help the Millennium Development Goals and reduce global warming. So that is fantastic. Founded in 2001 as a nonprofit organization, the World Toilet Organization aims to make sanitation a key global issue, and announces it has 55 member groups from 42 countries. So who would ever know? If you're looking for a community service organization to join, a world community service organization, then this would certainly would be one. The WTO, the World Toilet Organization. I'm sure they probably have a website. I haven't looked at it yet, but they probably have one. This is an item in the news I thought was interesting. This is one that talks about a group representing New York City police officers. And they were challenged in court. They're challenging in court Thursday a new rule requiring that officers take a sobriety test after they fire their service revolvers. And why in the world would we have an assumption? I mean, we put police through all kinds of stringent requirements to get on, and then we check up on them while they're working. And, you know, again, if you look at national polls that are done every year, contrary to public opinion, most people of all classes and communities believe the police are doing essentially a good job, and some think they're doing an outstanding job. But anyway, they're going to put every cop that's involved in some type of shooting, they're going to make them take a sobriety test. And the New York City Patrolman's Benevolent Association, which is not a small organization, it represents about 24,000 officers in the agency, said that the new rule was a violation of New York City police officers' right to be free of unreasonable government searches and seizures. So here they are bringing up the Fourth Amendment in this case. Why should they submit to a sobriety test? And what's interesting about this, it says, the gentleman says, since he became PBA president in 1999, there have been over 500 on-duty officers involved in shootings, and there's not been one single case where an officer was found unfit for duty. And that comes from Patrick Lynch, who's the president of the Patrolman's Benevolent Association. So that is rather odd, and I'd be curious what others would think about this. Why would we subject the police to this? Because there doesn't seem like there's any need. You know, a lot of these agencies have mandatory drug testing and random drug testing. The results of those have been, almost nil across the country. I could talk about some of those agencies that do it and what the results have been, but you probably don't want to hear about that tonight. But he says what this is a the mandatory breathalyzer policy was a knee-jerk reaction to community unrest over the for the sake of political expediency. And this has to do with the case of Sean Bell, age 23, was fatally shot by police on the eve of a scheduled wedding last year. And I don't know if you remember the facts of that case, but they were coming out of a nightclub that was under surveillance, and one thing led to another, and there was some shooting, and Mr. Bell, of course, was killed. It says Bell and two friends were fired upon by police as they left a bachelor party in his honor at a strip club in the borough of Queens, New York. This club was under surveillance by police who were looking for evidence of prostitution, illegal guns, and drug dealing. So anyway, when it was all done, there's a hail of about 50 bullets, and Mr. Bell ends up dead. But again, the officers in those cases were not under the influence of anything. So that's interesting. Switching to the correction side of the criminal justice system, this is one that's getting a lot of attention today. I talked about it to a group of folks today, but we have another state that's staying in execution, and that was Nevada. And within 90 minutes to spare, the Nevada Supreme Court stayed the execution of a convicted murderer for at least 60 days. And there's something special about his case that I'll mention here in a moment, but this was late Monday, to consider whether the three-drug cocktail used in lethal injection constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. Nevada, you know now, has become the fifth state to stop a scheduled execution since September 25, when the United States Supreme Court agreed to hear a similar appeal by two men on Kentucky's death row. What's this all about? It's kind of complicated and technical. I can just imagine what the expert testimony in this particular case will look like. It has looked like in state Supreme Courts across the nation and even lower level appeals courts. But lawyers for this Kentucky man, they argue that first drug administered, sodium thiopental, sometimes fails to render an inmate fully unconscious, and this allows him to experience pain. Meanwhile, the second drug, pancuronium bromide, paralyzes him and leaves him without the ability to move or call for help, as the third drug, potassium chloride, stops the heart, an often painful process. That combination, opponents say, violates the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. So unlike the Kentucky case, what's different about this one, Mr. William Castillo, age 34, he did not wish to postpone his execution. And he instructed the court-appointed lawyer not to appeal his case. But the American Civil Liberties Union of Nevada was granted legal standing to oppose Mr. Castillo's execution on behalf of a Spanish-language newspaper in the Reno area, Ahora, which contends that masking the suffering of a dying inmate, are you ready for this? Masking the suffering of a dying inmate violates the news media's right to observe the impact of the punishment. You have to think through that one a couple of times. If they're saying masking this punishment that he goes through, this excruciating pain that apparently is covered up, violates their right to see the inmate receive the full impact of the punishment. Well, I got to stop and think about that one a little bit. And, this must have been a pretty clever lawyer to convince somebody on that particular issue. So instead of being an Eighth Amendment issue, they stopped the case on the issue that this is a broader First Amendment principle, says Lee Rowland, the ACLU lawyer who argued the case. So really interesting situation, isn't it? He says this is not simply a matter of one person's request to die. It's about the broader power of the state. No one, not Mr. Castillo or you or I, has the right to petition the government to be tortured. Interesting. Of the 38 states who have the death penalty, all but one now use lethal injection. Nebraska uses the electric chair since the United States Supreme Court agreed to hear the Kentucky case. The top courts in Arizona, Arkansas, Delaware, and Texas have ruled likewise that all lethal injections must wait until the Supreme Court. I thought we had somebody here in Ohio scheduled for execution coming up before Christmas, but perhaps that isn't true. If you're interested in that, you can go to the Death Penalty Information Center run by Joe Dieter and his organization. It's a fine site for up-to-date data. The NAACP also has a fine site that tracks execution, so you can use your Google search and find that information there. But throughout history, we've struggled with the issue of the death penalty, and again, the advocates for curtailing the death penalty are excited right now because they feel that maybe the court will rule on this one and say that this three-drug cocktail is unconstitutional, and then the next effort, I suppose, is go to the next type of execution and declare it unconstitutional. If you know anything about the history of executions, you realize that throughout history and in our antecedent English legal system, they've used about every kind you can think of. Hanging was the most popular in the United States until the 1880s, while hanging continued to be popular. But in the 1880s, you had, Thomas Edison, who was working very hard to electrify America, and he was trying to do that with DC current, like in your car battery. And then you had George Westinghouse, who proposed to electrify America by using AC current, like you have coming out of your wall circuit. And these gentlemen went to court against each other numerous times, and of course, whoever won in terms of electrifying America was, I guess both of them turned out okay, but were likely to make a lot of money. So in one of these court cases, Thomas Edison says to, in the court, he says about Westinghouse, he says, you know, that AC current that he's proposing is really deadly. I mean, that can kill people. And the warden up at Auburn Prison in New York says, it can. And he went and commissioned his carpenter for the prison system in Auburn to build an electric chair. And lo and behold, the first guy to, in fact, I have some pictures of it in an old newspaper book. The first guy to get executed was a guy named Willie Kemmler. And Willie Kemmler killed his mistress, Ziegler. And when they decided to have this electrocution, they let reporters come in and sit in the chair and hang out and that type of thing. And when they were doing that, these reporters said, well, you know, things like, you know, the chair isn't very comfortable. And, of course, the warden and folks would come back, well, you know, the guy's not going to be sitting there too long because we are going to execute him. Anyway, they go ahead with his execution, and it was sort of a botched affair, as many of them in the electric chair are. There was blood and twisting and jerking and all that business, and it took a considerable amount of time. But so when it was all over, these reporters said, and there was a direct quote that said, this is the last person that will ever be put to death by electrocution, since this was such a horrible thing. Well, wrong, right? Right. Never underestimate human ingenuity and the creative talents of U.S. citizens, and they finally perfected, to some degree, the electric chair, and of course we used it for the longest period of time, and of course Nebraska still, I don't think Nebraska's had an execution since who knows when, but it's still in service in some places. And what these states do, they have many of them have a primary means of execution, and then if that should happen to be declared unconstitutional, their legislature has already approved a secondary means of execution. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see what happens in this this case. And those of you who were around back in 1999 when Ohio executed its first person since the 1970s, there was a moratorium on the death penalty from 72 to 76. You had two court decisions. 1972, Furman versus Georgia stopped executions essentially for 4 years, and in 1976 Gregg versus Georgia started them back up. And what that decision actually said is you had to have a two-stage hearing, one to determine guilt or innocence, and then one to determine whether or not what the sentence that somebody would get. And in that second hearing you had to consider the aggravating and mitigating circumstances of the crime, so that you consider fairly whether or not this person should get the death penalty. And prior to that time, in the 1972 decision, Furman versus Georgia, the Supreme Court said this was about as fair as being struck by lightning, because if you looked at all these cases and all these petitioners where cases were brought forward, that it didn't make any sense as to who got the death penalty and who didn't. There was no rationale for it. It was almost like being struck by lightning. So anyway, that got us started on death penalty. Then in 1999, the first one in Ohio, he was in fact a volunteer who wanted to be executed. Ohio spent millions of dollars trying to keep him alive, but we finally executed him by lethal injection. So that's kind of interesting. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're still waiting for our guest, and this has never happened before, so this is new. So I'll continue here on with some of our news stories. There are certainly lots of them to take a look at, but there's a report that just came out based on the new law that's kind of interesting I wanted to talk with our guests tonight about, and it's U.S. reports that 2002 deaths, that's 2000, the number 2002 deaths and arrests in the years 2003 to 2005. At least 2002 people died during their arrest by state and local law enforcement officers from 2003 through 2005, according to a new Justice Department report. This report is the result of something called the Death in Custody Reporting Act, which requires that state agencies complete questionnaires on the issues as a condition of receiving federal corrections grants. But of those suspects, officers themselves killed more than half of those 2,002 people, 80% of whom the officers reported had threatened or assaulted them with a weapon. So I suppose in an odd way, it's good that the officers are able essentially to survive these cases. It said that Drug and alcohol intoxication was the second leading cause of death, accounting for about 13%. So that takes us up to like 93% right there. And that was followed by suicide, accidental injuries, and illnesses or other natural causes. The study, it's the first federal assessment of meth deaths related to arrests by state and local agencies. And I suppose we'll be hearing a lot more about this particular report over the years, but it's interesting data. And this was it has to be done in 47 states and the District of Columbia. And again, they'll be losing their funds if they don't get this. All in all, the study dealt with a pool of nearly 40 million arrests. So related deaths were quite rare in the relative sense, about one death in every 20,000 arrests. I think that's a report, that's a figure that needs to be presented to the public, and you find it buried on page whatever, the New York Times or something else. But I think the general public, many of them would believe that police officers are involved in many more deaths than that when you consider the millions of arrests that are made each year. I don't think people realize either what happens that, about half of all the people, this is an average now with all the Part 1 crimes, but about half of all the people arrested, and this is held up for decades, are released almost immediately. So they actually don't go through the criminal justice system. And I suppose the other surprise figure is that more than 90% of these people arrested, when they're processed through the system, they actually plead guilty. And that's probably a result of a plea bargain where they get some reduced sentence or reduction in multiple charges or something like that. But most people would think from watching television that these cases end up in a trial. And, of course, they don't. So kind of an interesting report here. It says California led the nation with 310 deaths, followed by Texas with 298, Florida with 204, New York 97, New Jersey 37, and then Connecticut 9. So actually, there are a lot of states that aren't even represented in this group. It said non-Hispanic whites accounted for 44% of the deaths, African Americans for 32%, and Hispanics for about 20%. Nearly all the dead were men, who averaged about 33 years of age. Interesting report. Of those who were killed. Let me see if I can track our switchboard here and see if maybe our guest has found us yet. He has not. So something has happened. I hope it's nothing nothing tragic. Of the people killed by officers, almost all were shot to death. Three-fourths of those killed by officers were suspected of a violent crime. It said, for the purpose of this study, the period of arrest was considered to span the time from the onset of the officers trying to apprehend the suspect until the booking. So it's from the minute you focus on them as a suspect until the time they're booked in the jail. Then it becomes part of another study. Beyond that, then it's the jail or the correction system. Two-thirds of these deaths occurred at the scene of the arrest, and the remainder at a police station or a booking facility. And, of course, that matches up with what we've known for years, that one of the most dangerous times for a police officer ever is making the arrest, and once the person is in custody, then the chance of being harmed by a suspect drops dramatically. Interesting thing, and enter the issue of the taser gun, which we've done an entire show on here on Blog Talk Radio in the past, and you can listen to that on one of the archives. The taser, we hear bad things about it all the time, but I haven't completely made up my mind about it, but I think it's valuable because it seems like in many places that have looked at this, and we talked about a news story last week, that really tens and thousands of arrests have been made where a taser's been used and people have not been harmed. We have had about 70-some deaths, but almost all of those can be related to some other primary issue and not the actual use of the taser. So what's happened in the data on this, it's cut down the deaths and injuries to citizens and police officers about 50%. And to me, that would make it worth using. Now, if it's just used at random a compliance issue, I told you to do this, and then zap, then, you know, maybe that's not the best way to use it. But on the other hand, if I'm trying to handcuff somebody that doesn't want to cooperate, I can save that person and myself a lot of trouble if he gets a five-second jolt with no lateral consequences. So kind of interesting. But this is going to be an interesting report to follow over the years. It says here, of the 252 intoxicated people who died, 198 succumbed at the arrest scene. Of those 198, a total of 157 had been handcuffed. So that's interesting, isn't it? That is a real interesting figure. Of the 198, 157 of them had been handcuffed. In all, the number of arrest-related deaths increased 13% over the course of the 3 years studied prior to this time. So we'll have people combing over this report, and I doubt if this is probably too technical to break out into the mainstream news or cable channels or talk radio, but I guess it is on talk radio if we're talking about it, but a very interesting document. I can imagine a lot of research is going to spur a lot of research on the part of academics and faculty members in the criminal justice field. While the report dealt primarily with deaths of suspects, it did find that 380 law enforcement officers died during arrest over those 3 years' time. That's a shame. Most by accident. Homicide was the second leading cause. So in the course of trying to make this arrest, something happened where I suppose an officer slipped or something like that. I'm going to get the full report and go through it myself. But a very interesting piece of work. I wanted to mention something tonight that I ran across in a New York Times technology section article. If you don't know about it, might be something that you could use for yourself. But there's a new web startup company. I've already used it. And this new web startup company is called TalkBox. And what TalkBox does is not totally unique, but some aspects of what it does are, it allows people with webcams and a broadband internet connection to conduct face-to-face, to conduct chats inside of a web browser. You can go to that site at www.tokbox.com, you can sign up there almost immediately. You can also link this to other sites. And as I said, there are other companies that allow you to do this, AOL, Yahoo, Microsoft's Instant Messenger does the same thing. But what's unique about TalkBox, you can send instant video email. So Vmail is now a real thing where you can actually just click on your camera, make up to a five-minute email message, and the whole thing will be recorded by video, and it'll shoot right out to your mail service. And it works on about everything that I've tried. I know people with Juno and Yahoo and Microsoft Hotmail and on and on and on, Register Mail. Everything you can think of, but it doesn't work on the email system that I use in my place of employment, and that's the Novell system, which I can't understand why. I don't understand how Novell sells their system, to be honest, but Gmail is is the most fantastic email system you can have right now, and Gmail is the one that will actually sign up colleges and universities for free. They did the entire University of Arizona system, 67,000 students and faculty and staff, and they did that in 3 weeks, and it's absolutely free. And if you haven't used Gmail, go to their Gmail site and sign up or write me a message, and I can send you an invitation, but it is absolutely fantastic. One of the things you'll really like about it, there are no storage limitations, and they'll tell you right away you don't have to ever throw away a message again. And then when you use the search facility, it locks right on it. So if you're interested in using something like that, then I'd take a look at TalkBox, T-O-K-B-O-X, TOKBOX.com, and see how you like video mail. Sometimes it's a little frightening, isn't it, to send your picture over the Internet like that. So if somebody's not wide awake and they pop on their mail and there you are, but it's something worth trying. I'm still looking for our guest, and it looks like something has happened that he's not going to be on tonight. You know, I think what I might do, if you folks don't mind, and nobody's called in yet to say that they do, is let's go ahead and play the third section that we didn't get to look at concerning the law and surveillance camera systems. And I've announced to some folks I'm going to do it, but I've got one more thing in the way before I get to that. But I've been tracking the surveillance camera business, and Danny Chandler certainly helped last week on the show, but I want to do a book on that. I even think I have the title right now, and it's called I See You, : the subtitle will be The Logic and Lunacy of Expanding Government Surveillance. And, you know, we're to the point, at least it seems to me, that virtually every movement, almost every sound, every transaction is now being recorded in so many ways and so many places. And I realize the importance of national security and the war on terror, et cetera, but I don't know if that's necessary. And I'm going to start out this book talking about the issue that I hear so often from friends, students, colleagues who say, well, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, what makes the difference if you're constantly under surveillance? And, you know, you don't have a right to privacy in public. I think it makes a difference, and we've dealt with that to some degree on the show that we did on surveillance. But let's take a look at this, listen to this segment tonight, and I think you'll find it very interesting. This is on Law and Disorder, Surveillance Part 3.
This is Law and Disorder.
In this third of our four-part series, Law and Disorder Examines Surveillance After 9/11, we'll speak with Michael Ratner, who's just back from Germany.
We just filed a 380-page complaint in German charging Donald Rumsfeld and other high U.S. administration officials with war crimes.
We'll talk to Mike Steinberg of the ACLU of Michigan about NSA spying.
The National Security Agency is engaged in warrantless wiretapping. We're winning some lawsuits, but the fight isn't over.
We'll talk to Stephen Wax, who's the federal public defender for the District of Oregon, who represented Brandon Mayfield.
Brandon Mayfield was accused of being involved in the Ochoa, Spain train bombing. It all turned out to be a fake, but his, sadly, is only one of hundreds, maybe thousands of cases of criminal and other harassment of Muslims all over this country.
And we'll talk to a student who found himself trapped in America.
He's only one of a representative of many, many anti-war groups that were surveilled in Operation Talon.
And we'll speak with the National Lawyers Guild about violent gang and terrorist organization files that are being kept now.
You know, when I was a lawyer in the 60s and 70s, we litigated against huge files that were kept by the administration, the terrorist index, the communist index. It's amazing to see that we're doing that again.
All that and more on this, the third part of our special four-part series, Surveillance and Criminalization of Dissent.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. Michael Ratner, welcome back from Germany. I saw your name all over the international press. You went there to try to get Donald Rumsfeld indicted as a war criminal. Tell us, what did Rumsfeld do, and why did you go to Germany, and how can you get him indicted in Germany?
You know, it turned out to be an extraordinary event in Berlin. I was in Berlin with a group of other human rights groups, lawyers, etc., to try and get them to begin a criminal investigation of Donald Rumsfeld. And other U.S. officials, George Tenet, former head of the CIA, some of the lawyers, Ewan Bybee, who wrote the torture memos. Our main plaintiffs in the case were 12 Iraqis who had been tortured at Abu Ghraib and at other places in Iraq. One of our plaintiffs, though, was also a man named Mohammed El-Khatani. Mohammed El-Khatani was in Guantanamo, still is, and he's the one that we got, I mean, an incredible link with Rumsfeld, because he was tortured for a period of 2 months, and there's a log that was actually of his torture that was actually exposed by Time magazine originally, that went over what happened to him, and Donald Rumsfeld essentially approved that log as it went along. So we had Rumsfeld really dead in the water on the fact that he committed war crimes. And then you had a situation where in the United States they've amnestied these guys for war crimes under the Military Commissions Act. So you have a situation where there is actually an opportunity for European countries who have what's called universal jurisdiction, a Pinochet-type jurisdiction, to actually go after these guys.
Explain what universal jurisdiction is.
Well, think about a pirate, Dahlia. Piracy was considered an international crime, and any country had an obligation, not just a right, but an obligation to bring a pirate to justice. In the modern time, we look at war crimes, such as torture, as similar to piracy, and those people are considered enemies of all human beings. It's called hostis humanis generis in Latin, actually. It means they're enemies of every one of us. And therefore, every country has the obligation to bring those people to justice. And Germany has actually set up a special law called universal jurisdiction because it has universal jurisdiction to prosecute people for war crimes. Germany and a number of other countries do. But they can only do that when the home country isn't going to do it. And now we know that the home country, the United States, isn't going to do it because, they haven't done it for three or four years now. And secondly, they have a law now that says they won't do it.
Bush said quite clearly, we do not torture. Who do we believe here? What did Rumsfeld do? What kind of proof do you have of what Rumsfeld did?
I think it's now basically acknowledged the U.S. has a torture program. Whether we call it torture or whether we call it a violation of the Geneva Conventions and of the humanitarian provisions of those, whatever label you want to put on it, most of the journalists, and there were literally scores of journalists who talked to us about this, they sort of accept that, yeah, we did this. But then they say to me either, well, isn't it an effective method against terrorism? Or they say, well, isn't this just going to fail? And what I say to them is, we know what Rumsfeld did here. Rumsfeld not only signed the torture logs or basically authorized Al-Qahtani's torture, but he signed papers and authorizations for everything from stress positions, chaining to the floor, dogs, stripping, hooding, the whole business. So whether we call that cruel treatment or torture is not the issue. In either case, they're war crimes, and you can prosecute these guys for war crimes. The real question that people ask is, well, is this really going to work in Germany? What I say to people, really, already this has worked. Already, when Rumsfeld resigned, and it was actually here in the studio at BAI when I first read the email that said Rumsfeld resigned, everybody was only talking about, you know, oh, he's resigned, and what did he do wrong with the way he fought the war in Iraq, and these kinds of things. Now Rumsfeld's name is linked to torture. In the public media and the public mind. So in some way, we've already been successful with this case. This mere filing of this case, not mere because it's a 320-page complaint in German, you can actually go to the CCR website, ccr-ny.org. It has lots of material on it, including the way to send a letter to the German prosecutor to say, go after this guy. So this has actually had a big effect, and even today as we speak, Rumsfeld's probably afraid to go to Germany right now.
Well, how can we make him afraid to go anywhere else? What's the laws in the rest of the EU?
Well, it's actually, if the Germans issue an arrest warrant, and he doesn't have to know about it, and he goes to another EU country, they can arrest him. He could be. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but then we're thinking of going to other countries as well. I mean, the Spanish, who prosecuted Pinochet, also have an open court like this, and maybe even more independence than the German prosecutors. And so we're looking at that in the next couple of months. We want, basically, our view is there should be no safe haven for torturers. Whether I see Rumsfeld go to jail or not, well, that's not really the issue for us. The issue is, first, accountability, and for our clients, who are the victims of this, They want to see it acknowledged that they were tortured and that it was wrong to do it. I mean, for them, that is absolutely crucial.
What kind of consciousness exists in Europe about what you tried to do? Would you say that more people in Europe are aware of Rumsfeld being named a torturer than here in the United States? What kind of press did it get? What kind of presence
did you have over there? Well, surprisingly, we got a lot of press here in the U.S. 2 years ago, we didn't get anything when we first tried this. If I get to Europe a week ago, and there's a front page story, 6 pages long, with everything about this case. I mean, pictures of everybody, you know, the Center for Constitutional Rights Library, the whole business. You know, on one level, Europe's very upset with this. They have this case. They have, in Italy, of course, people know they've indicted 20 or so CIA agents for kidnapping an Egyptian cleric off the streets. Germany, they have a similar situation. They may well indict CIA people for the kidnapping of Al-Masri out of Macedonia, completely innocent guy. He was on a bus on the way from Germany to Macedonia, kidnapped, rendered, tortured in Afghanistan. And one of the cases, Spain is now looking at it now, because all these CIA guys, after they kidnap these people, they vacation at a hotel in Majorca, and they vacation under their own names. They even buy occasionally at night pornographic films, according to the records of the Spanish magistrate who's looking into it. But they all dumbly go to the Spanish hotel in Majorca. And so now Europe is getting somewhere. Look, Europe talks out of the side of its mouth also, because on one level, they're very close to the United States. And another level, some of the judges are a little independent. So there's some movement for sure. And I think, to me, what the Rumsfeld case represented, and the reaction particularly, is that the world is changing a little bit, even in the U.S. I mean, the idea that the Times would put in a long article about this indicates that that people have had it with Rumsfeld, and they've had it with torture on some level.
We all remember Brandon Mayfield, the Muslim attorney in Portland, Oregon, who was picked up on a material witness warrant and held, publicly accused of being the Madrid train bomber, despite the fact that he had an expired passport and hadn't left the country in quite some time. And he was held publicly accused, and a smear campaign was set upon him, despite the fact that the government had little to no evidence to connect him to the crime. He's a guy that you would think they wouldn't really touch, and they came up with nothing to really destroy his life, to hold him in prison and publicly accuse him of doing this horrible crime that he didn't commit. But the other part of this is we got an inside look into what the government is doing every day across this country, this secret surveillance. They went into his home. They downloaded the contents of several computers. They took photographs. They took DNA samples. When you're joking about putting that Q-tip in the trash and having your DNA sample on it, that's what they did to him. They fished in his trash and they took this stuff. They took the contents of his children's computers. One of his children had written an essay, a junior high school essay, opposing the invasion of Afghanistan as a response to what happened on 9/11. So we're really pleased to have with us today Steve Wax, who's the federal public defender for the District of Oregon, who handled Brandon's case in those early days when he was a material witness. Steve Wax, thanks for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Pleasure to be here.
Steve, tell us about your client, Brandon Mayfield, and his case.
Brandon was arrested on May 6, 2004, on a material witness warrant that allegedly connected him to the bombings that had taken place in Spain in March of that year, in which 191 people were killed and more than 2,000 were injured. Among the people who were killed were three Americans. The warrant that was used to arrest Mr. Mayfield listed a number of terrorism statutes that are on the U.S. books that could have led to a death penalty had he been charged and convicted.
Well, what we remember about this case, a lot of us, is that Brandon Mayfield, he was picked up on this material witness warrant, and we've been covering this for a while, so our listeners will remember that the material witness warrant is a warrant that allows the federal government to pick up and hold somebody who is a witness if they need them, and then that allows them not to charge that person. That person doesn't have to have an attorney. That person can just be held.
Well, the person does have a right to counsel.
Ah.
And that's how we got into the case. Among the material witness statute issues that Mr. Mayfield's case generated were whether or not it was an appropriate use of the statute to pick him up. Among the documents that have come out since I concluded my representation of him through the civil litigation, which is currently ongoing with other counsel, are some internal documents and emails from one FBI office to another, as well as reports that came from leaks out of FBI and DOJ people in Washington, which include statements that they never had any intention of questioning him, never thought that they would ever get any information from him, which raises a question as to whether or not the use of the material witness warrant to arrest him was appropriate, or it was a device that was used to hold him while they hoped to generate enough information to actually indict him.
And they did that to scores of Muslim men across the country. He's not the only one.
That's for sure.
I remember vaguely the affidavit in the case that had to do with him being, I don't know if I mentioned that he was a convert to Muslim, the Muslim religion, but I do remember something about him representing somebody in a custody case who was then accused of a terrorism crime, which is one piece of evidence. Another piece was that he was prayed at a mosque that maybe the same guy was a member of. And then the third thing was something about a fingerprint. Can you just talk about some of those issues?
Sure. The first and main part of the affidavit was related to the fingerprint. The eighth paragraph of the affidavit described the FBI analysis of a latent print that had been lifted from a bag at one of the train stations in Spain, compared with Mr. Mayfield's prints, and the FBI declared a 100% identification. That's the language in the warrant. I tried my first criminal case now 32 years ago, and I don't recall ever seeing a report that used the phrase 100% before.
Amazing. That's really, I didn't realize that. I'm not a criminal defense lawyer, but that's quite interesting.
Yeah. And as it turned out,
well, ladies and gentlemen, I see Audrey's giving us her usual signal near the end of the show. And again, I apologize that we weren't able to have our guest on tonight to discuss the United States Marshal Service. Perhaps we can reschedule for that, and I certainly hope nothing, ill will was there. No action has occurred or anything like that. But anyway, we'll check up on that and follow up. I'm having real good luck with Marshall. The Marshal actually asked me to be on the show earlier in the year, and he didn't come back either. So we'll try again on the United States Marshal Service. It's a fine service and very important to the security and actually the prosperity of our nation. So, Audrey, thank you very much again tonight, and folks, we'll see you next week. If you want some information about that Law and Disorder show, that's part three. Send me an email. You can get that off the website, and I'll give you a location where you can find that. So I'm sure we'll be meeting again. So tonight, ladies and gentlemen, look forward to seeing you next week.
Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that if you saw me go, I was singing this song. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again someday.